Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. This recording and the festival itself take place on the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to ancestors and elders, past and present. We hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
My name is Chloe Sargent. I'm delighted to welcome you all here today. Let's introduce our wonderful panellists. Next to me, I have the wonderful Jacinta Parsons. She is a broadcaster, radio maker, writer, public speaker, and author of the memoir Unseen, The Secret Life of Chronic Illness. She currently hosts afternoons on ABC Melbourne, delivering a popular mix of art, culture, and ideas. Next, we have the wonderful Kylie Maslin, who's a writer, critic, and the author of Show Me Where It Hurts, Living with Invisible Illness. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, Mean Gin, Kill Your Darlings, Adelaide Review, Crikey and Junkie, among other outlets. In 2018, she won Kill Your Darlings New Critics Award, and her essay, I'm Trying to Tell You I'm Not Okay, was longlisted for the Lifted Brow and RMIT Nonfiction Lab Prize for Experimental Nonfiction. She lives in Adelaide on Guana Country. And finally, we have the excellent Fiona Murphy. Fiona is a deaf poet and essayist. Her work has been published in Kill Your Darlings, Overland, The Big Issue, Griffith Review, among other publications. In 2019, she was awarded the Overland Fair Australia Essay Prize. Her memoir, The Shape of Sound, is about the corrosive power of secrets, stigma, and shame. All right, let's give a little round of applause for our wonderful, wonderful panellists. Okay, so, we all ready? Let's go. All right, so there's, I think we've probably all noticed, and if you're in this crowd, you've noticed that there's been a really incredible uprising of books and writing about the lived experience of chronic illness and disability in sort of the best part of the last decade, which you and all of your work is a part of. So why do we think there has been this sort of sudden boom in these stories? Jacinta, we'll start with you.
It's interesting that it happens, isn't it? The way that we are finding ourselves in a similar place of rethinking and speaking about our experiences at the same time. I mean, it was incredible, Kylie, your book came out almost at the same time as mine did, and I was like, oh my goodness, it's such a similar experience that's being referenced. But I think when we have that collective experience, it's because we've had shifts that have happened culturally and that are significant enough that they become languaged differently by all of us. We begin to understand our own experience with the depth that then we can start talking about it. I think for me, being able to write this book was really about a shift in me as well, a way to explain it to a community and to each other and to myself that I possibly hadn't been able to do 10 years ago. And so it's actually incredible that there is an audience to speak to and a way that we can speak to ourselves that perhaps, as I said, has emerged, recently.
Mm. Absolutely.
Kylie? I think, we are all women on the panel, and a lot of the books in company with ours are also written by women. And I think a large part of that is because of the reframing of feminism into an intersectional sense, and therefore giving voice to women's experiences beyond the sort of white, heterosexual, cisgendered sense. A lot of us have experienced elements of misogyny in our search for better health and for diagnoses and stuff. And so I think it wasn't possible for us to write these books until those broader conversations were being had.
Absolutely, yeah. Fiona, what about yourself?
I definitely agree on all the points raised with that. And I do think that it should be acknowledged that these stories have existed for hundreds of years and decades, but I think publishing is kind of been slow on the uptake to acknowledge that these stories exist and there's a market and a demand for it. And I think it is taking that of seeing these books not only be published, but there's this great hunger and desire for them that publishing is starting to acknowledge that, yes, there isn't just, this isn't a niche topic. This goes across so many different life experiences that people are interested in reading about and exploring and understanding. And I think it also gives writers this strong kind of feeling that their story matters and is important, and they can point to books that exist on bookshelves of saying, yeah, I can picture my story belonging with them. That was certainly my experience of when I was a very young writer, of not seeing any deaf stories. I came into writing through reading about chronic illness and other forms of disability to bolster my confidence that my experiences are worthwhile writing about and thinking about and could be published one day. So I think there is that sense of kind of almost a gathering together of voices into a collective, which is so exciting. And I think publishing is still catching up to that idea as well, that there's so many more stories to be told as well, to really get that true intersectionality of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I have experienced that when it's like, it is framed as this niche sort of topic, and it's absolutely not. Like, we're such an enormous, massive community all together, especially in Australia, and like, there's so many of us, and our stories, they're so wide and varied, and yet it's, you know, even if you're not disabled yourself, then someone you love probably is, you know, and so it's not a niche topic. And I, like you said, I think publishing is slowly catching up to it, but it's nice to see this boom has kind of begun, you know. The other thing that I hear quite a lot from chronically ill and disabled writers is that they wanted to write the book that they needed, but it didn't exist. You know, like when they first started to get sick, when they started thinking about their disability, there were no books. There was nothing to sort of help them learn about their identity and all of that kind of thing. Was that something that you experienced writing your books? Fee, I'll go back to you.
Absolutely. So the only kind of story about hearing loss or deafness that I had access to for all of my schooling and well into my early 20s was Helen Keller's story, which is a tremendous story. And also the way it's been told, she's been venerated into this superhero. So I obviously could not live up to anything that she had experienced. So that was almost an interesting kind of silencing of, well, I can't talk about my experience because there's Helen Keller, amazing. But having the opportunity to start to meet other deaf and hard of hearing people on Twitter has been life-changing, because a lot of people in the deaf community really struggle with that deaf identity, particularly if they're not fluent in Auslan. There's a real sense of, are you deaf enough to call yourself deaf? But having conversations with other people really gave me a lot of courage to go, yeah, I'm not Helen Keller, but I do have experiences as well with hearing loss and communication and the friction and barriers that exist in trying to navigate the world.
Absolutely. Kylie, what about yourself?
I definitely... There were elements of wanting to write a book for my younger self in order to, like, validate the pain that I had experienced for a long time that many doctors had told me was not real or that I was exaggerating. So there was definitely writing in order to help others feel seen. But I also felt like we had reached a point with endometriosis in particular, and that we had had a lot of kind of public awareness campaigns to let people know that endometriosis was a thing that exists, but no one was really talking about what does it look like on a day-to-day level to have endometriosis or to have neuropathic pain, which I have as a result. And so that was kind of a really motivating factor for me, was to take it beyond an invisible experience and to present it in a way that people could really see how it impacts every single facet of my life.
Absolutely.
What about yourself? Probably in a similar way, I felt like it took me a while to sort of, same as you, Fiona, to recognise it. maybe I had something to talk about. But I found it really important to disclose the experience, the experience of Crohn's disease, and a lot of it is, you know, traditionally kind of shameful stuff. We don't talk about our bodily functions the way that it really impacts us. And so I thought it was important to speak about it for my younger self, but for a community that haven't really said the things out loud, so that there is a reframing of it, a normalizing of it, a pride in it, I think. And I think that's partly saying these things and not shying away from them, writing them, is about pride, and it's about love, and it's about ensuring that our stories aren't told for us. So
removing
removing stigma by the nuance of our lives. You know, they're also different, but there is a commonality in them, and in that same kind of way of reclaiming what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you sort of just mentioned, we still to this day so often see disabled people's stories told for us by able-bodied people. And the resulting stories will often fall under the territory of inspiration porn, which was spoken about by the late, great Stella Young. So why do we think that it is so important that we tell our own stories? Kylie, I'll start with you.
I think it's crucial that our voices and that of every other minority is heard, because it removes the more that our stories are told, it removes the othering of these stories and builds us into the mainstream rather than kind of siphoning our stories. And so therefore, it's not something that's looked on as a niche or as a, you know, something that happens in the distance in a corner somewhere. It's something that's happening to people that you work with, people that are in your family, that you love, people who are in the stands with you at the footy on the weekend. It's really kind of as a way of connecting us all in together and a way of understanding each other a lot better.
Absolutely. Fiona, what about yourself?
I really like the idea of connecting those experiences, because I think even though there's so many specific labels and diagnoses within disability and chronic illness, I think there's this kind of really amazing feeling that you get when you read someone else's book of their experience and go, I can relate to this on some level, particularly around ideas of fatigue and the amount of planning that goes into organising your life so that you can access the world and be able to attend events like this. I'm sure a great deal of us in this room have put a lot of planning into being here today and also planning to recover afterwards. And that experience that happens again and again and again, day after day after day, of the level of detail and forethought that we put into living our lives is, I think, not documented well in medical literature, certainly not spoken about in any appointments that I've had with any audiologist. The idea of listening and concentration fatigue and the headaches and just the being so unwell continuously from having to manage these things, I've had to learn from other people within the deaf community of these are real things and there are real strategies that go with how to negotiate these kind of ever-present obstacles. And also reading Jacinta's and Kylie's work just gave me a sense of belonging, even though I'm never experienced what's in your bodies, but being in the world together, having to strategize constantly is the reality of it. And there's, I think, Stella Young's work where she really pushed against the idea of inspiration and just kind of really grounded it in the fact that it's a fight and it's still a fight is fantastic, that that's still a key point that needs to be raised in disability conversations.
Yeah, And it sort of goes back to what Kylie was saying about, like, we so rarely see stories. Well, for a long time, we rarely saw stories about just the everyday impact of living with chronic illness or disability. And, you know, so the mental planning sort of stuff, like you said, there's many people in this room that, you know, have already planned their recovery after this festival and all of that sort of thing. I know I have. But it is that everyday level of story that we don't really see unless we write those stories ourselves, you know, like it's because we often hide that away from the world, you know, for better or worse. And so, yeah, the only way those stories are going to be told is if we get to tell them ourselves. So what about yourself, Jacinta?
Yeah, I think I love exactly what you both said. I think reading both of your books was, it's such a revelation because so much of this is done internally and in isolation, and because it's not seen, we don't disclose all the time. So being able to read experiences and having the sense, as you said, Fiona, of connection, but that connection is allowance of normality as well, of saying this is actually, I'm not alone, and that not isolation, that knowing that the experience is had by others validates it and then validates our coping, our existence. And I think also that concept of non-othering. Once we understand the nuance of all of our lives, the only thing that is normal is not being normal. But we are always masking those parts of ourselves in this cultural framework that we lose the beauty. And I think it's such a revelation, and it's such a wonderful experience to allow and to do that within a community of writers and reading.
Yeah, and also to be able to sort of share the beauty and the strength that is our everyday lives, because I think that there is an enormous amount of strength in, you know, what we do on a daily basis as chronically ill and disabled women. And it is one of those things that, you know, if we got to tell those stories ourselves, we could do that and talk about our strength. But, you know, when able-bodied people tell those stories, it comes off as, oh, they're so inspiring for getting out of bed every morning. And it's not that at all. If I do something inspiring, then I'm inspiring. But getting out of bed isn't one of them. But if we get to tell those stories ourselves, we get to talk about the actual strength and power of our everyday lives. So let's talk about writing books, shall we? I think we can all agree writing a book is really bloody hard. Even for able-bodied people, they complain about it. So when it comes to what was your experience like managing chronic illness and disability while trying to write a book? Jacinta, I'll start with you.
Well, there's definitely a physical component just in the actual sitting and doing it. It hurts, like from an illness perspective. So, and obviously fatigue is something that is... it's something in my life that I've managed to the point that I ignore it, but it is absolutely a massive part of the physical experience of it. But it also was just such a beautiful experience to write a truth and to tell it in the way that is intimate and pure is such an honour and such an opportunity. So it was a really arduous experience, but it was also an absolute joy to have that opportunity to find the words to say and to share an experience that has been such a profound one in my life.
What about yourself, Fiona?
It was definitely took a lot of drafting to get to the point of having that courage to share the truth. So the first version of the manuscript that I wrote was very much drawing on medical research to bolster my truth, because at that stage I didn't feel that I could say anything without having 10 journal articles to support any of my experiences. And that was something my editor really had to say, people will believe you. And I was like, nah, I don't think so.
I need receipts.
Yes. Well, one of the things I found really striking in that all of our books, we have pages of references to go with our books, which is something that you won't often find in memoir, because in different life experiences, some people, the audience will accept this truth. But I think coming from a disability and chronic illness perspective, that sense of kind of faking it or exaggerating it is so real that it's almost an imperative to be like, no, actually, I've got hundreds of journal articles to prove that this is a real thing. So that was kind of the first iteration of the manuscript, and then kind of getting the confidence to be like, okay, there are people who believe me. So then kind of softening it and letting my own voice into the story was terrifying and something that I had to take a lot of breaks from doing, because having had a secret for so long and not disclosing my deafness, I didn't actually have the language around talking about hearing loss in a way that was anything but defensive and or even personal. So it took a lot of drafting to even find my voice on the page that wasn't qualified with multiple studies. But yeah, a hard, hard process.
Yeah. No, sure. I honestly hadn't even thought about that. Every book I've read about chronic illness or disability has always had pages and pages.
So just many references. Like, yeah.
Our books are tomes because of this back end of references. But yeah, it's probably after years and years of the, you know, medical industry as well telling us that we're being dramatic or we're being this. We're used to not being believed. So of course that's a sort of a go-to in that situation. You're like, no, I need these receipts to yeah. show that it's all real, I promise. Mm-hmm. Kylie, what about yourself?
Yeah, there was definitely... just to follow on from that, a big part of I hadn't been believed for such a long time, so it was important for me to link to that material, but also so that readers who were new to reading about this sort of experience had places that they can then go to for more information. And a lot of the chapters in my book refer to pop culture references in order to explain to people without chronic pain or mental illness what it is like living with it. And so I wanted to be able to give real examples of where people could go to learn more about what this life kind of looks like. But I think the main thing in terms of writing the book was that I was really challenged. I had been before, but I hadn't really listened. I was really challenged in my own kind of ingrained ableism on the productivity of self-worth. And so getting really angry with myself when I couldn't write anymore on a particular day, and you know, wanting to work 9 till 5, 5 days a week when I'm physically in no way able to do that, but I had this big important thing that I wanted to do, and so I wanted to be doing it every hour of the day. But also in writing about these experiences, I went, you know, I had to go back through some really difficult times that I had gone through. There's two particular scenes with two of the past gynecologists that I had whose bed manner was not great. Yeah, reliving that in detail was, yeah, pretty shitty. But I think really important in order for other people to see, particularly people outside of our community, for people to see that we go through these experiences and this is something that we deal with. I always felt like there was a point to that, but it was not enjoyable.
Yeah, it is. And I think it is really, really important that we talk about that, you know, books are a labour of love, but when we're talking and about the topics that we're talking about and sharing stories like our own, it is
there is a lot of trauma involved, and I think it is really important to acknowledge that people who write books about disability and chronic illness and all of these types of topics have to go through their experiences with like a fine-tooth comb, and there's a lot of sort of like trauma that comes back up with all of this type of stuff. So is that something that you guys all went through, you know, Jacinta, is that something that you experienced?
Yeah, definitely. It's I think it's also acknowledging the trauma. It's always there a bit, you know. I think when you write about it, it gives it a space to exist. But it's also having a moment in your life to sit with it and realise the trauma that you're living with all the time as a result of it. I just found what you both said so fascinating too, just around the writing of it and the trauma too, just sort of writing this down and almost facing the power structures, you know, the doctors and the hospitals, and calling it out is frightening. And it's still frightening for me to think, oh God, who's read it and what's going to happen, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think the trauma is often in those power dynamics that you have in the health industry, and they remain. It hasn't changed. So whilst it's traumatic, it really is, I think that's a truth to the existence, as opposed to this process being something that was particular from my experience.
One of my very final edits, I went through the manuscript like with a fine-tooth comb on a sentence-by-sentence level, thinking what could Alan Jones pick up? Like one particular sentence, like what could be
Absolutely.
Something yeah. that was could be pulled up in isolation and be kind of used against me? And because that was a very real fear that I had publishing these experiences. And so, thankfully, touch wood, that hasn't happened yet. I don't think I'm important enough for him, thankfully. But yeah, they're definitely the challenging of power, and therefore, and you know, now that you put the book out, you're in these sorts of events and you're talking on radio and doing that kind of thing.
It's a totally different level of putting yourself out there
again. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because I'm currently writing my book because I live with fibromyalgia, and it wasn't something that I really sort of properly thought about or processed, that I was going to have to sort of relive all of this trauma with different doctors and all these memories of horrific, you know, medical situations. And it was really one of those things that it really sort of like hit me like a truck. I was like, oh, I'm really going to have to go through all of this again. And like you said, it's like the trauma sort of never really quite goes away 100%. It always sticks with you, and you don't realise it until you sort of, it's all there in front of you and you're trying to come up with the words to properly explain it, you know? Was it something that you experienced as well, Fiona?
Absolutely. And that's something I, in retrospect, I think I could have managed a little bit better. Very much what Kylie was saying of that kind of productivity sort of mentality of like really just wanting to people please and meet the deadlines was something that I struggled with, of just even though it was at certain elements in long before getting a book contract, of just wanting to be quite productive, even at a cost of like, yep, I'm just going to write this really hard section and it'll be done and closed and all the rest of it. Looking back on it, I really got to quite a low level, just reliving a lot of those experiences in quite a condensed time frame was not healthy. But I'm glad that I went through it, and I think anyone who is considering writing about those experiences of having friends and family or trusted people to kind of just use as a sounding board to kind of just
check in,
express and check in.
Yeah.
But exactly about the idea of really dissecting and speaking about the systems of healthcare is terrifying. As a healthcare worker working within the system, I felt terror in the sense that of wanting to make sure that I kind of looked at my own sort of responsibility as a healthcare worker. And for a long time, all the ableist ideas that I had so deeply ingrained in myself of making sure as a physiotherapist that we did rehab correctly and we got the best results no matter what. And looking back, I'm like, oh my goodness, these ideas that I had really drummed into me are just so damaging and horrific to people with disability. And that was something that I really wanted to try and put on the page of kind of reckoning with my own change of perspective. But it was really terrifying because it's not something that I'm proud of kind of the thoughts that I had initially of what it meant to be a good healthcare worker is really not what people with disability need of kind of reaching the expected outcomes of treatment and therapy. And I hope that this starts a conversation of how healthcare can adjust to really center the patient, not just for accreditation and ticking boxes, but to truly have patient-centered care that is holistic and meaningful and really embodies a sense of dignity and respect that isn't just lip service, but is the start of something that is a new model of care. I do have a lot of doubts around whether we're on track with that at the moment because of healthcare funding models don't promote that model of care at all. But I think more and more books that come out from the disabled perspective, the chronic illness perspective, I believe is amassing a kind of real sort of outpouring and a pressure that can be exerted on the system in a way that can create change. So I think whilst it is terrifying, I think books that do that should be celebrated because certainly as a health professional hat, I learned so much, which excites me. And also from a disability perspective, I felt a sense of a collectiveness, a kind of a sense of community, which can never be underestimated. Particularly with disability and the systems that we have, it silos it off to the individual, the burden of the individual, self-responsibility. But I think if we can kind of join together as a community, we can really push back.
Absolutely. And I've even witnessed that with, like I was saying, that sort of boom of chronic illness and disability, books about people's lived experiences that have come out recently. I've seen so many medical professionals that have gone to the effort of reading these things just to sort of learn more about what our day-to-day lives are like and that sort of thing. And I've even experienced it with, I host a podcast about chronic illness and I've had medical professionals contact me and go, I didn't even think about that. Thank you so much. I've never thought about that before.
And it's certainly not taught in university at all, unless those syllabuses are changing now, but it's very much the medical model is the overriding model that exists. But
And it's what we have embedded in ourselves so much so that in writing these books, and for me, it was also a reckoning with my own ableism, so that understanding myself as I had as a disgusting body, having to really challenge that was a vulnerability as well. Having to expose those ableist constructions that I had lived in, is a similar kind of experience that is built into us through the system.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's something that I am challenging at the moment, actually, or finding challenging at the moment in that I have, on a day-to-day level, have an incredible team. I'm so lucky that I happen to live in the best state for pelvic pain management. And the Adelaide Pelvic Pain Network is just a really incredible, holistic framework where GPs, gynaes, physios, therapists, psychiatrists, all talk to each other and all work within this circle. But now I'm going through the process of applying for NDIS, which is incredibly reliant on patient advocacy and questioning everything that you do every day and who is looking after that. And it's really brutal. And let alone like building yourself up to the fact to acknowledging that you are worthy of NDIS and you should be applying for NDIS, then to be hitting these sorts of roadblocks, I guess.
Like is, disabled imposter syndrome kind
yeah,
of thing.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's been a really stark reminder of what the broader system looks like. And when you are fortunate enough to live amongst the social model of disability and particularly supported by a community of people who are chronically ill and disabled who sit within that, to then kind of jump outside and immediately be met with the medical model is really confronting.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's as much as I would love to get into a big old rant about the NDIS, I'm not sure if we've got time for that today.
That's a whole hour.
That is a whole other session. I've got my last sort of question for all of you, if that's okay. There's probably people in this room that would love to write about their experiences. So would you each like to sort of share what advice you might have for someone that wants to tell their story but sort of doesn't know how to start or is struggling to sort of, as we were talking about, challenge their internalised ableism or, you know, there's a billion different reasons. But yeah, so what advice would we give? Fiona, I'll start with you.
I was extremely lucky to have quite a lot of mentors along the way, particularly Fiona Wright and Jessica White. Having a kind of that support gave me a lot of confidence within myself and kept me on track. So if you have a friend within the writing community or someone that you can talk to writing about, that definitely is helpful on a practical level and extremely helpful on an emotional level as well. So kind of finding mentors is really worthwhile.
I would agree with that. I was also mentored by Fiona Wright, who in a glowing review of Fiona Murphy's book the other day was referred to as our patron saint.
She is.
She's wonderful. But
shout out to Fiona.
Yeah, as a starting point, I would recommend going to your local Writing New South Wales, Writing Victoria, Writing South Australia, whatever is your state-based group, because they will always have great connections as to and programs for mentoring. My other advice would be to not only tell your family and friends that you are going to be writing about this, because they will no doubt be drawn into it at some point, but you will need their support. I mean, in my case, I couldn't have written it without my psychologist, who is just the most phenomenal human, but also it was really, there were a lot of times writing this book where it was really difficult managing my bipolar because I was reliving some of these traumatic details or the stress of getting the book done in time, was sort of bringing on episodes. So I think it's really important to make time for your own health and to prioritise that and to make sure that you're day-to-day practitioners are on board with you as well and can support you through the process.
It's like the sort of weighing up between productivity and managing those expectations and making sure you're actually looking after your own physical and mental health, yeah. Because we all know that's a big old knife edge, isn't it? What about yourself, Jacinta?
I
agree entirely with that. And I think also start small. I think some of the things that resonate with you, that tiny little revelation that you've had about your experience, just write that rather than trying to write the big story, because the big story is so overwhelming. But begin in those little parts of the story and honour them and give them that fine detail that really exposes them for what they are.
Mm. I'm finding writing little pockets is really helping me at the moment, where it's like, I just write all these little stories and I'll figure out what order they go in at a later date. That is not my priority right now. All right, well, how do we feel about some questions? Is that, would anyone feel like they would like to ask some questions of our excellent and talented panelists?
So I'm a family member of someone who lived once with a disability, very similar to what you guys are talking about. And I haven't read a lot of the memoirs out there. Fiona Wright, I've read. And it's really heartwarming to hear you talk about the internalised ableism, the shame that is no fault of your own, that comes with having a chronic illness that's often invisible. I'm sorry, I don't know your name in the middle. Can you?
Kylie.
I noticed you talk for a moment there briefly about bipolar. So my sister had a diagnosis of chronic fatigue for a number of eight or 9 years, then chronic Lyme disease for about 3 or 4, and she euthanized herself for a number of years ago. And she also had sort of a comorbid bipolar diagnosis, but because of the shame, because of the intensity of the shame that was heaped upon her by the medical industry and by, you know, even within the family, it was really, really difficult for her to talk about the mental, to even accept or acknowledge the mental illness component, wherever it came from, whether it came from a result of the trauma of the physical experience, or they were bound up in each other, or they were just separate. Is that something that you recognise?
Absolutely. I mean, I have complex mental illness, so it's not just bipolar. I have a bunch of other little things on the side. But I've been diagnosed as having comorbid bipolar, which means that my bipolar 2 and my neuropathic pain kind of feed off each other, and they're both nerve-based, so they kind of signals keep firing up and down through my spine. So it's definitely, I think it was, I nearly didn't write about bipolar in the book because I had only just been diagnosed as well. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 35. But it felt really important for me to write about that because I hadn't heard about it before. And I don't think, and I think part of that comes to the shame of having mental illness. But also, there's a lot in my book about just the mental health and mental illness ramifications of having chronic illness in the first place, and all of those years of being doubted, and when you're spending so much time in bed with pain, or you know, not being able to go out with your friends and having to cancel all the time and feeling really isolated from people has a huge mental toll. And I was very depressed for a long time as a result of that. And so, yeah, I'm really sorry to hear about your sister, but I think that we talk about the stigma of mental illness quite a lot in the kind of broad mainstream now, but I think we don't talk about the complexity of it. And so, yeah, that was important for me to raise in the book.
Yeah, and I think there are so many people with chronic illness that, you know, their mental illness is so related in terms of like comorbidity and that sort of thing. And so it is, the more we write books and speak about our experiences, people like your sister, and there's, you know, so many people like your sister out here in the world, that the more we speak about it, the more it's going to become a more common conversation and a more normalised conversation. Mm.
And thank you for listening to your sister and for advocating on her behalf, yeah.
I was just going to talk about shame, picking up from what has been said. It was the beginning part of my book, because it was the biggest part that reckoning with how much we hide and how much we are afraid to share because of the world around us, and that we internalise the ableism, and that's shame, the shame, and dealing with that. There's a pathway to the pride, but it begins at that point of reckoning with, you know, that experience. And I think it's a huge one for a lot of people. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think we may have time for one more question, if there is anyone. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Firstly, I'd just like to say a huge thank you to all of you for writing your memoirs. It's just so liberating to read other people's stories and realise, as you said, there's a whole community out there. So it's amazing. So thank you, firstly. The question I have, and it kind of came up a little bit, around power structures. So you're all writing from a place of trying to kind of push against the boundaries of power structures, but you're also presumably still patients. So how did you manage that tension?
It's really genuinely, as I mentioned before, a scary thing. I luckily have a gastroenterologist that I trust, and so I asked him to work with me on some of those things and to, you know, help me against some of the people that he works with that have that power. It's when we're, you know, I have a condition called trying to be a good patient, you know, the whole time, and making sure you're not a problem. And yeah. Then you write a book and you are a problem,
yeah,
you know.
The number one problem patient.
It's scary. We're vulnerable. We really need the health, you know, environments and structures to support us and like us. When they like you, it feels like you get better care. So you need to be likable. So being the loud person had never served me very well. So I think, I know you've all had this experience. Yeah, it's. I still think it's a very frightening thing to do. I don't think we're in a safe place necessarily to be calling it out.
Yeah, this really interesting discussion that happens kind of offline or in chronic illness circles about the way that you should present yourself when you go to hospital if you end up in an emergency. Like, should you wear makeup? Should you not wear makeup? Should you wear tracksuit pants and be comfortable? Or should you wear something vaguely work attire-ish, that's not a word, in order to look like someone who is not a drug seeker? You know, like this, it's just like kind of constant, really gross expectations, I think, or conversations around that. Again, I'm really fortunate that I have, just after decades of searching, have found the most incredible GP and psychologist, and they both supported me a lot throughout the writing of the book. They helped me with fact-checking a few bits and pieces. And what's been really interesting, actually, is... my worst fear has been recognised in that my therapist has now brought up stuff that I've written in the book that I hadn't told him. But also my GP is like, oh, I feel like I found out so much more about you as a person by reading the book. I mean, it's very personal. And so it's actually kind of helped grow our connection in a different way. And those two people in particular, I see more than members of my family and my friends. So even though it shares kind of power structures within the medical system, they're very aware of it because they are incredible patient advocates. And so actually having these experiences written down is something that they can then draw on and present to other people in their, their colleagues and peers, and kind of use it as an example of, actually, this is what we're doing to people. We might not realise it, but
this is something that we need to challenge ourselves on and that we need to start taking into consideration far more than we have been.
I think it's also probably important to acknowledge that as white people,
yes,
we have, even though we've gone through hell and high water with some of our medical, with the medical institutions that we have done for the past, you know, for me a decade, for yourselves of varying lengths of time, that there is a level of white privilege involved in that as well. That, so like Indigenous women, you know, like women of colour, they are generally, that the treatment that they will receive is even longer and worse. So, you know, the power structures involved there are a lot. We've got a long battle ahead of us, but like I said,
that was important for me to write about in the book, was to acknowledge that, you know, endometriosis doesn't just affect women, that the experiences of people who, for whom English is not their first language, is incredibly different to mine, especially going through the hospital system. And yeah, that people of colour and black women, First Nations women, the way that they are treated with complete disregard, and I draw on the pregnancy stories for both Beyoncé and Serena Williams, who were, you know, they are the most powerful, wealthy queens, and they were disbelieved, disregarded. Their lives were put in very real danger by doctors who didn't believe them. So, you know, if it can happen to Beyoncé, it can happen to anyone.
Yeah, the power structures, there's so many different levels and variables involved in terms of intersectionality when it comes to disability and chronic illness that, yeah, all we can do is keep telling our stories and try to make space for people that, like, our First Nations background, and try to do that as well, so we can get as many stories into the mix as possible, you know, because, as we're saying, we've got a long way to go. It's still really frightening. It's still really scary.
I'll just quickly add, I absolutely agree with the whole idea of being the good patient. That's something that I find myself falling into time and time again, and I think it's that wanting to please, be treated well, but also I think the structures in place really put the imperative on that this is a timely interaction. Our time as health professionals is really precious, and we need to get through this as quickly as possible. And I think there's a lot of architectural cues in hospitals that do that. It's kind of the opposite to a casino. There are clocks everywhere. Everyone is aware that how long they've waited, and this is a timely exchange. Yep, it's the whole environment is built around the concept of time, and that the health professional's time is the most valuable time in the whole environment. But also the language of the institution itself is incredibly built around the idea of capitalism, with the push towards calling people no longer our patients, but their clients and consumers. But that almost reinforces the conversation of a burden in place. So if you need more than your fair share, well, you're a burden, and we have to justify how much care we give you. So there's money involved in this conversation. There are lots of things well beyond that human interaction that I believe really needs to shift dramatically to ensure that it actually is a fair and equitable service, because certainly there is deep racism in the system. There's a real push of this misogyny in the system. And I believe that we need to start shifting the language that we use. And also on a kind of within pop culture, the amount of ableist slurs that I encounter on a daily basis is rampant. That happens on Twitter, and we're still very much the butt of jokes and comedy and disrespected time and time again for living in bodies that should be treated equally. So I think power comes with language. If we start shifting our language, I might be an optimist, but I believe we can shift the system slowly but surely.
thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.